Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopez, and today I have the immense pleasure of being here with Dr. Robert Plomin. He is professor of behavioral genetics at the Social Genetic and Developmental Psychiatry Center at King's College London and research professor at the Medical Research Council. He's one of the leading figures in the entire field of behavioral genetics, and is also the author of many books, including Behavioral Genetics, A Primer, Separate Lives, Why Siblings Are So Different, Nature and Nurture, An Introduction to Human Behavioral Genetics, Nature and Nurture During Infancy and Early Childhood, G is for Genes, and the most recent one, Blueprint, How DNA Makes Us Who We Are. So, Dr. Plomin, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's really a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Ricardo. I look forward to it.
Okay, good. Okay, so since I'm talking with you, I would really like to first ask you a general question about the field of behavioral genetics. So, would you like perhaps to tell us a little bit about its history? Because I mean, when I hear about behavioral genetics, people usually go all the way back to Sir Francis Galton and people like that. So could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the history can go much farther back, right? Animal breeding has gone on for thousands of years. So there's that long history. The modern history most people date as say 1960, with this book by Fuller and Scott called Behavior Genetics. That was mostly about animal research. But you know, Francis Galton does deserve credit for thinking about individual differences and the extent to which his cousin Darwin's ideas about inheritance might be relevant, not to species averages, but rather to individual differences within a species. He proposed really twin and adoption designs in a way, and those first studies were done in the early 20s. And there were a number of studies into the 30s and the 40s, twin and adoption. In the 50s, there were quite a few animal studies comparing inbred strains of mice and selection studies of mice that were very powerful demonstrations of genetic influence, because they're actually experimental approaches, you know, where you can select artificially for characteristics. And that's kind of the proof that genetics is important from my point of view. It gets rid of all the other complexities about it, because that's what inheritance is about. But then it was in the 60s and 70s, there was a real backlash against this just early buds of behavioral genetics. And partly that was due to Jensen and Herrnstein and books that were probably, well, they just upset people and made people notice, I think, that there's this insurgence of genetics. And they thought it had been wiped out by the 19 eugenics and Nazi Germany. And but that's about when I came on the scene, say in 1970, I was in graduate school. And people need to be reminded of how much things have changed. Because in the 1970s, in the textbooks we had in psychology, genetics wasn't mentioned. The only mention you might get are like relatively rare single gene or chromosomal anomalies, you know, like Down syndrome. But that's just sort of mentioned on the side. Everything was thought to be environmental. You know, we actually learned that schizophrenia was caused by what your mother does to you in the first few years of life. Environmentalism was so dominant that it was dangerous sometimes, well, professionally for sure, and sometimes even personally, to talk about genetics. People were just so convinced environment was good, genetics is bad. And so that was in the early 1970s. And in these 40 years, there's been an amazing change in how people perceive genetics, how much they're afraid of it, how much they know about it. And in part, that's because of the data we collected on twin and adoption and family studies over four decades. But what really made a difference, I think, was the DNA revolution, because then it became much more real, because you're talking about specific bits of DNA sequence. So this was sort of the context in which I decided to write this book, Blueprint, And I was actually asked by a publisher to write it 30 years ago. But I realized then that the timing wasn't really right. There was a lot more data that needed to be collected. No one then had really thought of the DNA revolution. It wasn't even the idea of sequencing the genome. You know, no one really thought that was within our lifetime. So I'm glad I waited, because there's so much data now that's piled up. I don't see how any serious scientist can deny genetic influence on individual differences, even in behavior. But the real difference is that the DNA revolution has come along. And I think the idea of not just talking abstractly about genetic components of variants, but talking about your DNA predicting your risk for alcoholism or schizophrenia, that's what's going to change everything in my perspective. So when the book was published in October, that was just 3 months ago, I was really very nervous about what kind of response I'd get. And I've been blown away. I mean, I had nightmares. I mean, friends of mine were telling me it's like a professional suicide note, you know, that you could be pilloried and, you know, really set up as a pariah for talking about genetics as the main systematic influence in what makes us who we are as individuals. And in this book, unlike a lot of my other work, I didn't pull punches. You know what I mean? I didn't hold back. I was just going to say what I think the data says, and then talk about implications, possible implications, but not worried so much about, you know, always trying to mollify people who are against genetics. I thought I was just going to come out and say it. Genetics is the major systematic influence making us who we are as individuals. And so the response has been amazingly positive from my point of view. You know, there's been a couple bad reviews, like one really weird one in Nature that we'll probably talk about. But it's been reviewed in all the major newspapers in the United Kingdom, and it was just published a few weeks ago in the States, and it's been Wall Street Journal, and it's going to be New York Times. So it's getting quite a bit of publicity. And the response has been really more positive than my wildest dreams, even academically, but in terms of the media, but especially in terms of people. You know, I've given a dozen talks at festivals and scientific, you know, I mean, for the public, events for the public, which seems to be, I'm very pleased to see, a real resurgence of interest in scientific events that people from the public go to and pay a lot of money to go to. I love it. And so in signing, I've signed hundreds of copies of the book. I've met a lot of the public, and I haven't had any hostility. Whereas when I was in graduate school, there were several times I was called a Nazi, you know, and it was really scary, you know, people, how angry they were at the thought of genetic influence. And now the main comment I get from the public that I absolutely love is that they're not against genetics. They just didn't know much about it. And they think it's perfectly reasonable. In fact, very often I've had like half a dozen people say, why is there so much controversy about this? It just seems so blindingly obvious that some of the differences, even between infants in early life, they're not something we just did to them as parents. You know, kids are different from birth. And so I'm just kind of enjoying it now, because it's quite a relief for me that I'm not, you know, just being attacked, you know, for this, that people are actually very excited about it. So, sorry, that's kind of a mixing my history with the history of behavioral genetics. But I think it's a, you know, you could talk about this for days probably. But I think that's probably more, as much history as most people would want to know probably.
Yes. But all of what you just said is very interesting. And I would like to pick up on one of the points you referred to, because, I mean, would it be correct to say that throughout most of psychology's history, environmentalism really dominated? Because, I mean, we had some very influential figures like Freud, like B.F. Skinner and behaviorism. And then perhaps, since you refer to, let's say, the advent of modern behavioral genetics in the 60s, 70s, perhaps that was really a very complicated time for it to arise, because it was precisely when we were going through the cultural and social revolutions. And I mean, people didn't really like the idea of us having some sort of innateness to our psychology, right?
No, I really agree with all of that. And again, that could be another day's discussion, probably, all of those issues. But was there something specific there you wanted to ask me about? Because I agree with everything you just said.
Well, I mean, perhaps if you could just comment on what you think were the influence, was the influence of environmental ideas in the history of psychology, because also apart from that, it just came to my mind that also fields like social psychology, unfortunately, have been influenced also a lot by these ideas. And I've even recently had on the show people like Dr. Lee Jessim, who has been reviewing a lot of the literature over that has been going over the last few decades in social psychology. And I mean, people tend to interpret the results through their own personal ideology, let's say, and then it also very easily gets into politics and things like that that are very, really complicated for for people, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I think at a fundamental level, it isn't just necessarily ideology. The reason environmentalism seems so acceptable is you can see it. You know, parents do things and there are certain outcomes for their kids. And to assume that these correlations are causal, you know, that the parents have environmentally made their kid to be the way they are, it just seems so, you know, if you don't think about it, it's perfectly reasonable. Schizophrenics have schizophrenic parents. No problem from an environmental perspective. You know, of course they do. You know, if your parents are psychotic, of course the kids are going to be psychotic environmentally. So the thing about environment is it's always reasonable. Whereas you don't see genetics in the same way. And so that's one reason why it's just easier for people to believe environmental influences. But the other ones, you know, the political ones are also there, certainly. You know, that the idea that, you know, some people would say the American Revolution is based on the idea that anyone can become president. And with the current president, maybe that seems to be true. But, yeah, it just sort of don't get me going on this because there's so much to say about that. I don't know. In some ways, I like focusing on the science of it because in the end, you know, I decided when I was called a Nazi and people were very upset about even talking about genetic influence in psychology in the 70s and 80s. I decided I wouldn't respond to criticisms like that because I found when you try to do it, the people who are making those criticisms, they're not doing science. It's like they don't have anything better to do. You know, and if you honestly address an issue like the equal assumptions, environments assumption of the twin method, you know, and you say there's a lot of data here and you go through it, it doesn't make any difference. They'll just say, yeah, but what about this? You know, and so you could spend your whole life doing that. And I decided if psychology is a science, eventually empirical data will win out. And I think that's what's happened over these 40 years. The mountain of evidence is such that I just don't see how a serious scientist can deny genetic influence on almost all psychological traits. So if there was something more specific you wanted to ask me about that, Ricardo, feel free, you know, during the entire interview. But these are really big issues and, unless we spend days on this interview, we're not going to get through much of it.
Yes, right. So, yes, but just before we get more specifically into the studies done in behavioral genetics, just one more question, because I've been thinking about this for a while, and I would like to know your opinion. So, I think that on the one hand, perhaps people also take into account what is innate about human beings, because I mean, I've been talking with a lot of evolutionary psychologists, for example, and one of the aspects related to theory of mind is that people really think about other people as if they have an essence, that is something that is separated from the environment, let's say, and so they would have innate traits, let's put it that way. But on the other hand, it's also true that genetics is something that we don't really have direct access to. And apart from that, it's also a very complicated discipline because we have to really learn a lot. And then we also have things like, for example, nowadays proteomics, that is, and also interactomics, the way proteins that are the products of genes interact with each other. So, I mean, I think that there's these two factors that, on the one hand, people have some innate intuitions about innateness, but on the other hand, it's also very difficult for people to understand how genetics work. So,
you're raising many topics there, and I think the one though that is an important one to address is the idea of what I call normative versus individual differences approaches, and there's different levels of analysis. So a lot of psychology is about universals. You know, in development, why do children learn to say words at 12 and two-word sentences at 18 on average? They're normative in the sense that this is on average, the human species does this. And evolutionary psychologists are very interested in why does the human species do X and other species, primates, don't, or, you know, whatever. So they're about averages, and that's important. Darwin was, in a way, talking about evolution in that sense. But what my view of genetics is at a very different level of analysis, and that's individual differences. So we've got to be clear that innateness and evolutionary adaptations, we're talking about this either universal or at least normative average level. And that's fine. These are different perspectives. They're not right or wrong. They're just more or less useful. But the key point is they're different levels of analysis. And one doesn't necessarily tell you about another. That is, something like language could be, and most people would say, evolutionarily constrained. I mean, you know, that man's a natural language user. It's not my area, but, you know, I think most people would think that that's a genetic phenomenon, that we've evolved somehow to lock in genetic variants that make it easier for us to learn language. That's at that universal level, though. And if that's true, that doesn't mean that individual differences in how children learn to speak, how fluent they are, that doesn't mean that's genetic. Because a really critical point to get by a lot of these difficult issues of group differences, ethnic differences, sex differences, is to realize that the causes of average differences between groups are not necessarily related to the causes of individual differences. So I know that's not exactly what you were asking about, but it is so important to realize that we're just talking about the 1% of DNA that differs between us. The 99% that's the same for all of us is what makes us human. Tremendously important to try and understand that. However, understanding individual differences is very important. These are questions about why are some people schizophrenic and others not? Why are some alcoholic? Or why are some kids reading disabled? So individual differences are, you could argue, socially, you know, the important question. But a lot of psychology is not addressing individual differences. And so I'm a big fan of studying individual differences rather than group differences, because I think the methods we have are very much more powerful to understand the causes of individual differences. And we don't have as definitive tools to address questions of average differences, even average differences between sexes, between males and females. It's very hard to pin that down. So again, something I could go on and on about, but I think if you want to follow up though, please feel free.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay, so now, let's talk a little bit about the types of studies that you do in behavioral genetics. Let's start with perhaps one type of study that has been one of the gold standard studies, at least throughout most of behavioral genetics, I think, that is the studies done with identical and fraternal twins reared apart. So why is it so important that the twins are reared apart? And what are perhaps other ways by which you control environmental factors in these types of studies?
Well, studies of identical twins reared apart are actually quite rare because, as you can imagine, not many identical twins are reared apart early in life. But they're very dramatic. You know, so there's a film that came out in the States earlier this summer called Three Identical Strangers. Have you run into that?
I think I did, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's being released now in the UK, and I think it'll be in Europe soon. And it's really worth seeing because these are three identical twins who... it's bad for science. I don't like advocating the film because there's a very bad science side of this, an ethical side. But what you see at first is this guy goes to the university for the first day in upstate New York. He grew up in Brooklyn, and he meets, and everyone's calling him Eddie, but his name's Dave. He's just first day on campus. He doesn't know anybody. But then he meets this guy, Eddie, and it's like looking in the mirror. These two guys are just so identical. And then not just in how they look, but in their personality. They're very outgoing, big smiles, you know, very vivacious sort of guys. And then also in psychopathology, they all had depressive symptoms. So they quickly started exploring what this was. They realized they were adopted. They were adopted from the same adoption agency in New York. One was raised in an upper class family, one in a lower class family. Well, this created huge publicity in the 80s. And as a result, though, this amazing thing happened, a third identical triplet in this case surfaced. And again, they're very hard to tell apart. They're so physically similar, and they're just similar in so many ways. So it's a dramatic illustration of how clones reared in different environments are amazingly similar. And these were the bad story. The bad part of the story is they were intentionally separated by the psychiatrist, who said, wouldn't it be a cool experience? Experiment. Let's put one in an upper class family, one in a middle class family, one in a lower class family, and not tell the parents that these are identical triplets. So they were studying these kids throughout early development, doing Super 8 films, which were developed back then, and never telling the parents that there are these identical triplets. So it's incredibly unethical. So that's the part of the film, you know, that bothers me. You know, it's not good for science. It's the mad scientist sort of thing again. But the first part of the film is a very dramatic illustration of how similar people are, clones are, if even though reared in different environments. And so that's kind of the bottom line of what I'm trying to say is it's not just that genetics is important. The environment's important, but it's not the environment that environmentalists always assumed was important, which is nurture, the idea that there are these systematic influences primarily due to the family. Schizophrenia runs in families because of nurture. It's the way the parents treat the kids. But the environment's important because heritability is generally about 50%, meaning of the differences between people in traits like personality, inherited DNA differences from that cell with which we began life. And now it's the same DNA in all our trillions of cells. Those DNA differences are making these differences that we call heritability. So it's big, 40, 50% of the differences, but it's not 100%. The rest of it is environment. It's not in the sense that it's not inherited DNA differences, which means anything else, which could be accidents, illnesses, biological causes, mutations that are not inherited, like cancers, skin cancers are not very heritable, but they primarily involve DNA mutations. But you don't pass them on to your offspring, and you didn't inherit them from your parents. So the tricky part of this message in Blueprint, that's why I say DNA is the major systematic influence making us who we are as individuals. The environment's important, but it's not that systematic environment. It's essentially random. And that's what people have real trouble trying to accept. These are real environmental influences, but but they're not the systematic influences shared by people growing up in the same family. And so that's why I think this film is important, because the bottom line of what I'm trying to say is that if you had been adopted at birth and reared in a different environment, had different family, parents, went to a different school, got in a different job, you would still be remarkably similar to who you are now. In fact, you'd be as similar as identical twins reared apart, because you are, in fact, your clone, right? I mean, this clone of yours who's reared in this different environment is your identical twin. So we could actually, so that wouldn't mean you're identical, because, you know, identical twins aren't identical for traits, but they're very, very similar. They're very noticeably similar. So I think that's why identical twins reared apart are so important, you know, as a dramatic illustration. But they're rare. And so that's why the vast majority of studies do not involve twins reared apart. They involve identical and non-identical twins reared together, because you'd still have to predict that if genetics is important, identical twins who are clones of one another, they're genetically identical, they have to be more similar for a trait if the trait is influenced by hair, by genetics, than are these non-identical fraternal dizygotic twins. So that's why the twin method is so valuable. And 1% of all births are twins. So there's a lot of twins out there. Mm-hmm. So that's the twin method.
Yes. So would it be a fair assessment to say that perhaps two of the main things that people have to take into account here is that when there's parent-offspring resemblance, perhaps part of it is also because parents and their children share genes, and also on the other hand, that even though we are influenced by our environment, those influences are genetically mediated. Would that be correct?
Yes. Yeah, no, exactly right. That is the point. And as we were saying before, environmentalism would make it easy for you to answer the question, why are parents and their children similar in weight, for example? And, you know, they correlate maybe 0.3 for weight. I assume your listeners know what a correlation is from 0 to 1. And so they correlate 0.3. Environmentalists said, right, of course, you know, the parents provide the food for the kid. They give them role models for diet and for activity and that sort of thing. But the other major method, well, first of all, twin method would show identical twins are much more similar than fraternal twins, about twice as similar. Not identical twins are not identical. They correlate maybe 0.6, not 1, 0.6. But they're twice as similar as non-identical twins. But the real killer design, I think, is the adoption design, which is like a social experiment. If the twin method is a biological experiment, that is, one-third of all twins are identical twins and two-thirds are non-identical twins. That's biological. It's not a real experiment. You haven't randomly assigned zygotes to identical and non-identical status. But, you know, it's pretty good as these experiments go, because they're both raised in the same womb. Half of fraternal twins are same-sex, so it's a little better experiment if you compare same-sex fraternal twins to identical twins, because they're always identical in sex, because they're genetically identical, right? So I forget where I was going with that, but I wanted to just say the twin method's important, but the adoption method is great because it's a completely different method. It has different assumptions, and yet the results converge on the conclusion from twin studies. And so with the body weight thing, I think it's really remarkable. There's been dozens of studies, including adoption studies. And what the adoption study shows is, yes, you know, kids and their parents correlate about 0.3 for weight. But the adoption method says, let's look at environmental parents, adoptive parents of kids who raise the kids from the first year of life. They correlate 0 for weight. So, you know, it can't be the similarity between parents and offspring for weight can't be due to this nurture, because here, these parents are nurturing the kids, giving them their food, giving them their lifestyle, and yet there's a 0 correlation. The other side of it then is, how about adopted kids and their birth parents, whom they never saw after the first few days of life? They correlate just the same, 0.3, as do parents who rear their kids. So if you put this together, it's another way of saying the same thing I said before. Genetics is very important, but the environment is also important. But whatever the environment is, it's not these systematic influences suggested by the word nurture. So I do want to emphasize, they are environmental influences. They're not inherited DNA differences. But the amazing thing is how different they are from the way environmentalists thought the environment works. If you think of obesity and body weight, for example, all the theories are these environmentalistic theories. And as I said before, they always make sense post hoc. You know, after the fact, you can, yeah, sure, that sounds reasonable. Parents give the kids food and lifestyle and all of that. But they're wrong. And I think that's an exciting part of this message, which is not, you know, it's what comes out of looking at all the data together. And so that's why I feel so good about writing the book now, because Blueprint, because it's a great time for pulling those data together. Because in a way, you can say we don't need more twin and adoption studies, because now you can do genetic studies, you can estimate genetic influence with DNA alone. You don't need special samples like twins and adoptees. What's more is any researcher can include DNA in their studies, not to find genes, but to use genes that other people have found, these polygenic scores that involve putting together thousands of DNA differences to predict genetic promise and problems for psychological traits. And that can be included in any study at a relatively little money compared to what we normally spend in psychological studies. So that's what makes it such an exciting moment in the history of psychology, because I know in these reviews, some people accuse me of, you know, being over the top on this, but I think I'm going to look back in a decade, and this is going to be a moment, a real tipping point in psychology, because you can see it happening already. Research is being really changed. People, big studies, they're all incorporating DNA into their studies now. And I think it's going to transform clinical psychology for reasons I talk about in the book. And I also think it'll help us in our self-understanding. So that's something I go into the book. I present the first profile of polygenic scores for psychological traits for me, just to explain, you know, people worry about the sky's going to fall if we knew our genetic risk for things. And I don't see it at all. I think people want to understand themselves. They take psychological tests that are very popular on the web because people want to know about themselves. But DNA tells you something about yourself that nothing else can. And so I just think it's tremendously exciting. And it bothers me that some people don't want to just say, great, you know, isn't that exciting? Let's, you know, we can do new things. And we're not just turning the same crank in psychology that some fields turn for decades. So anyway, I'm not embarrassed about being a cheerleader for this stuff. Because I don't know why doom mongers, you know, people are always saying, oh, there's all these worries and, you know, this is all terrible. Man, I don't understand why people aren't, you know, just happy to have new toys to play with. And I think it's just so exciting, really.
Right. And still about the environment, isn't it also the case that it is really very difficult to control for confounding factors coming from the environment? Because I mean, it's also the case that it is extremely difficult to account for the effects like things like accidents and unique events have in our lives.
Yeah, correct. Exactly right. That, my colleague, John DeFries, with whom I did all my early work in the 70s and 80s at the University of Colorado at Boulder, he said from the start, when we first started realizing, John Lolan, who's a famous behavioral geneticist, wrote this book in 1976 called The Heredity of Personality. And in that, he first pointed out that this finding about it's not nurture. Environment's important, but whatever it is, it's this non-shared environment. It's not making two kids in the same family any more similar than kids in different families. Well, I said, well, shouldn't we be trying to find out what these influences are? Because all the previous studies only study one child per family. So they can't ask, what are the environmental factors that make kids growing up in the same family different from one another? And identical twins are particularly good tools for this because genetics doesn't make them different because they're identical genetically. The only thing that makes them different are these non-shared environmental influences. So I thought it was really a great way to go. But John DeFries said back then, he says it's just idiosyncratic, chance, stochastic, random effects. You know, genetics can't program things. It just kind of nudges you in directions, and that's as it should be, because you want this environmental flexibility. You don't want these genetic influences to be programmed and deterministic and hardwired, because that makes you inflexible as well. But for 30 years then, I and lots of other people tried to find out what these influences are. And as you say, it's very hard to pin them down, because what's an accident, you know? And even an illness, or a famous example for me is Bill Clinton, you know, the president of the United States, said he became interested in politics because at the age of 16, he shook John F. Kennedy's hand. And people do talk about that, looking back on their lives, these significant moments that are turning points in their life. Now, you never know how much that is just retrospective, telling a story about your life. I think, as you're suggesting, a lot of it is kind of random chance events. Now, the other part of this that's really fascinating to me is, as you alluded to before, a lot of what looks like systematic environmental effects are actually mediated genetically. And so parents, it's correlations don't imply causation. So correlations between parent behavior and kids' outcomes, you can't assume that's environmentally causal from parent to child. Increasingly, I'm convinced that parents are mostly responding to genetic differences in their kids. I have one grandson, you know, who I always thought, what grandparents supposed to do? I have six grandchildren. I thought I used to sit on a sofa with them, you read to them, and you know, you improve their mind or something. This guy won't have it. I mean, he just always want to go, and he wants the roughhouse play. And it would almost be abusive if I made him sit there and I'm going to read to you. And you know, you respond to the kids' differences. But more than that, I think what we haven't even touched in psychology is what I think the ultimate impact of this, we call it GE correlation, gene environment correlation, is that DNA doesn't do anything by itself. It has to have an environment to do something in, an evolutionarily expected environment. You know, you need oxygen, you need food. So these people say, how can height be heritable? Because if you lock a kid in the closet and don't feed them, they're going to be stunted in growth. Well, that they're just missing the point. We're talking about the normal range of variation and individual differences in DNA and environments that exist in this normal range. Sorry, I got off track on that. So where were we going with that? Where were we starting with that?
About the correlation, gene-environment correlations,
yeah. So more important, I think, than just parents and teachers reacting to differences in their kids is the idea of what I call active GE correlation. That is, you know, the most highly heritable cognitive test is vocabulary. And people say, how can that be? But they're thinking DNA somehow puts vocabulary words in our heads. Well, it obviously doesn't, but it makes some kids more attuned to language. I have another grandchild who is always asking, you know, you say some word and they want to know about the nuances of words. Well, but why did you use that word rather than this word? And that other grandson I mentioned, you know, he would say, whatever, you know what I mean. It doesn't matter what, you know, you get the idea. And so I think that's an important a fundamental shift in the way we think about the environment. From learning theory, we thought of the environment, and most psychologists still do think of the environment as something out there that happens to us. You know, we're kind of passive recipients, like a rat in a cage who the experimenter either shocks or doesn't shock. But that's not the way the environment works. The environment works, we create our own environments and we select them and we modify them in a way that's correlated with our genetic tendencies. So that's this nature of nurture topic, which is a chapter in my book that I think is so important to realize that what looks like, when you get correlations between environment and behavioral outcomes, you can't assume that it's caused in the direction from environment to behavior. More and more, I think it's the other way around, that our genetic correlation. It's another long story.
And I mean, once I learned about gene environment correlations, it really changed the way I look at people's behavior and human psychology. Because I mean, when I look back at the time when I was a child, I really remember now that I actively looked for books to read, and I went through my mother's collection of cassettes to watch movies from ancient Rome and things like that. Because I mean, of course, I was stimulated also by my parents to do so, but they didn't really put me in a place and tell me and told me, oh, now we are going to watch this movie or something like that. It was really I who choose the types of movies that I watched and the time I spent reading and all of those things. So I think that's really a very powerful thing to take into account.
I really agree. My story is even maybe more dramatic because my family, no one went to university. We had no books in our house when I grew up. Just a tiny flat, a one-bedroom flat with me, my sister, and my parents in an inner city Chicago. And because they grew up in the Depression, they didn't go to school. It certainly didn't go to university. And they just weren't into reading. And I don't know why. It wasn't anybody. It was just like you. I just liked to read. And I picked up reading at a very early age. So I went to the public library and I'd bring back a wagon load of books and I would just read. My sister was never into reading. She was never into school and academics, whereas I just loved it. You know, I couldn't wait to go to school. I thought it was fun, but partly it's because you're good at it and you like to do what you're good at. My sister didn't like it and wasn't good at it. And, you know, and then that kind of snowballs, doesn't it? And so I think it is such an important way to think about the environment, not this passive model in which the environment's out there and it happens to us, but this active model of experience in which we select and modify and create environments that are correlated with our genetic propensities. So I think that is a very important direction for research, and we still really don't have a handle on it. Who's studying this sort of active approach to the environment? You know, I don't see we have measures of it. It's really hard to try and measure it, but I think that's where we ought to be going, looking at this interplay between genes and environment.
Right. Okay, so when in the first law of behavioral genetics, and I hope that I'm saying this correctly, you say that behavioral traits are all heritable, what does that mean exactly? That the ways people behave are the ones that are allowed for by our genetics, or not exactly that?
Well, the first part was right. I think as a marker for how much things have changed. In the 70s, when I was in graduate school, if you said anything in psychology was heritable, showed genetic influence, people get very upset. And now we can say, show me any trait that does not show significant genetic influence. That's how much things have changed. And so this is a way of just kind of challenging people on that, to say everything that we've studied shows genetic influence. But the second part of what you were asking about is to sort of to define heritability. And it is very important to do that. That, as I said before, we're not talking about that it's the same for all of us that makes us human, but the 1% that differs. But there's 3 billion base pairs of DNA, so that means there's millions of DNA differences between us. So that's the first point, that we're only talking about differences. And then the second is, we're only talking about differences as they exist in the populations we study at that time, with that mix of genetic and environmental influence. It's merely descriptive. We're describing how much of the variants can be ascribed to individual differences in inherited DNA versus the rest, which we call environment. And then thirdly, so the second point is we're dealing with this normal range of variation that we study in our sample. So we're not studying extreme mutations. So traits that are heritable 20-30%, there can still be a mutation that causes huge differences for an individual. But it's so rare. Most of those rare single gene mutations are one in hundreds of thousands of individuals. So if you have a sample of a few thousand individuals, you're not going to have that represented. And similarly, on the other side, and this is where people get upset about, is we're not studying environmental mutations. That is, we're not studying environments that aren't part of the normal range either. And so by saying these family influences aren't important, you get people really upset because they're, you know, talking about abuse, severe abuse and neglect. And I'm saying we can only study what we study. And, you know, these other events could be very important. Now, some people argue, but they're not rare. Well, then I would say if they're not rare and they're common, neglect and abuse, then we are studying them and they're not important. You know, so take your choice. But it is important to emphasize we're only describing what is. We're not predicting what could be. So sure, there could be other cultures where you get very different results. What's been surprising to me, really, is to see that these results are pretty similar around the world. You know, like the heritability of cognitive abilities seems to be the case in rural India and developed India and in some countries that are very poor and other countries that are wealthy. It doesn't have to be that way. I don't have any investment in it being that way. It's just those are the data so far. But we can only describe particular populations. It doesn't predict what would be in other populations. And by the way, experiments are basically about what could be rather than what is. So if you go into a lab and you do something and people respond a certain way, that means, yes, in those situations, you can make them do something, but it doesn't mean that's the cause of individual differences out there in the real world, which is another major mistake in psychology, because that's, again, a normative approach. We say, yeah, you assign people randomly to groups, everybody's kind of the same. And you know what we call individual differences in experimental analysis? In ANOVA, it's the error term, individual differences. Well, it's the error term that we're studying. We want to know why people are different in the real world. We don't want to say, on average, if you do this to people, you can change their behavior. You know, not to say that's a bad thing to do. I mean, you want to maybe know how you can change behavior. That's great. But you can't assume then that what could be is the cause of what is. And we can't assume that the causes of what is tell us something about what could be. A trait could be completely heritable and you could change it absolutely environmentally. You know, an example that's often given is tooth decay. Individual differences in tooth decay shows a strong genetic component. But there are people who say modern dentistry and preventive dentistry with flossing and, you know, staining your teeth, you could eliminate plaque, the major cause of tooth decay, immediately. So completely heritable, maybe highly heritable, and yet you can change it environmentally. So I'm glad you're bringing up these points because I think a lot of people, they haven't really thought it through much. What I find talking to people is everyone says, yeah, you know, DNA revolution, but you scratch the surface of what people know and they really don't know very much. And so another reason I wanted to write the book is that I think the DNA revolution is happening in psychology and it's time to launch a discussion about it, you know, and its implications for psychology and society. And to do that, though, people need a certain level of DNA literacy and genetic literacy. And you know, it sounds pompous to say that, but I think by a lot of people's comments, it's clear that they don't really understand how DNA works. And so I think it is important that we kind of up the game in terms of getting people to the level where they can really participate in these discussions. And I think it'll make them less hostile if they kind of know what's going on, rather than, I find if you talk to people about it, about what they know about DNA, it often does have this sort of mystical homunculus flavor to it. Genes are something in your head that are making you do things. It's so important to realize these are just dumb chemicals. So it's great to have opportunities like this to explain to people. I'm not actually too sure who your audience is. I assume they're scientifically literate, interested people particularly, but who is your audience?
Well, I agree with you, at least with the people I've been interacting, most of them are really already scientifically minded and are interested in topics, particularly from psychology and things like that. So I would say that's right. Okay.
Right.
So I think that another thing that the environmentalists speak on to try to make an argument against behavioral genetics and innateness and even perhaps genetics in general is the fact that complex traits, and in this case we can refer to behavioral traits, they are all polygenic. And so, I mean, there's that small complication that perhaps from studies done with, again, twins and adoptees, we know that a particular behavioral trait is, for example, 50% heritable, but then at least until now through genome-wide association studies, we have only identified, for example, a particular number of genes that account only for, I don't know, 10% of the variance, for example. So, I mean, and that's another thing that people usually refer to when they try to dismiss the effects of genetics and things like that.
Right. Well, first we should know there are two different issues. One is, to what extent are inherited DNA differences in total? And identical twin studies, I mean, studies of twins and study of adoptees all converge on the conclusion that about half of the differences between people are heritable. This other issue of identifying the DNA differences responsible for heritability is a different issue. And the progress has actually been amazing. Now, I'll come back to only 10% and what that means, but the first genome-wide association studies that were done, well, first of all, there were the candidate gene studies that never replicated. So that was kind of a downer for people doing that. But when the genome-wide association studies were done, I don't know if should I explain what that means? Well, it was just, instead of a candidate gene approach where you say, well, certain neurotransmitters like serotonin are probably important in depression, instead of identifying genes you think are important, which we could only do back then because you can only study a few genes, you know, economically. It was very difficult to do. Then a new technology came along, these chips, DNA chips that have, that are able to genotype on a platform as small as a postage stamp, hundreds of thousands of DNA differences. So that's when people decided we could look at DNA differences throughout the whole genome, and it's just the opposite of a candidate gene approach. These genome-wide association studies are atheoretical. They said, let's just look at DNA differences throughout all 23 pairs of chromosomes and ask if any of those make a difference. But to do that, you need huge studies. So the first study was done, the big one, in 2007, one of the most highly cited studies in science. It was like cited tens of thousands of times. They found differences, significant differences, correcting for a million tests. You know, in psychology, we know about multiple testing, but here we're talking about testing a million hypotheses at the same time. There are like a million different kind of more or less independent units in the genome of 3 billion base pairs. So even with that sort of massive correction, you're not talking about 0.05 significance, you're talking about 0.0000005 because you're correcting for all those multiple tests. They still found some significant differences. But what was amazing was that the biggest differences were incredibly small. They're accounting for, like, in continuous traits like height and weight, 0.02% percent of the variants. That's 0.0002 of the variants. Those are the biggest effects. So if those are the biggest effects, then the other effects must be smaller and much smaller. So that's when people realize that what you need are massive studies. I mean, psychologists know this. If you're trying to detect small effects, you need big studies to do it, to have the power to detect those effects. But this is like many magnitudes greater problem than any psychologist has imagined, to detect effects that account for much less than 0.02% of the variance. So that's been the big development in the last few years. So in my area, I'm interested in cognitive development and the business end of it in education, how kids do at school. And 3 years ago, with identified SNPs, these DNA differences called single nucleotide polymorphisms, we were able to identify 0% of the variants. 2 years ago, 3%, last year, 10%, and this year, 16% of the differences between children. Now, you can say, but that's only, you said only 10%. Well, you know, this is only 16%, but the advance has been amazing to explain 16% of the variants, first of all, and it doesn't look like it's tapering off. It looks like by getting these massive studies, the last one was over 1 million people, because then only then you begin to scoop up these small effects in any sort of reliable way. So we haven't seen the end of it. I predict in the book that we're going to double our predictive power in the next few years. But still, say we get up to 25% or 30% of the variants explained by DNA alone. I should emphasize, this is just DNA from any cell in your body because they all have the same DNA. So even if we explain 30%, though, these tests of educational achievement are about 60% heritable. So we're only explaining half of the variants that's genetic. And there's lots of interest in this issue of missing heritability and what causes it. We could go into that. But the point I'd like to make is you've got to be careful about saying only 10% or only 30%, because I would challenge people, first of all, we're explaining more variants in educational achievement with DNA than we can explain based on the parents' educational achievement, you know, whether they went to university or not, for example. So in the behavioral sciences, most of the findings people talk about are explaining much less than 5% of the variants. What we're doing here is we're putting effect size up front, not statistical significance, which is, I think, you know, that's a big controversy in psychology, that maybe the reasons why there's this replication crisis is that we focused on p-values and significance and, you know, the stuff about chasing p-values and that sort of thing. It's a real scandal. I wrote a paper a couple years ago, saying what excites me about behavioral genetics is these results replicate, you know, over the decades. And I think that's really important. And part of the reason for that is to focus on effect size rather than statistical significance. So this effect size of, say 15% of the variance of educational achievement. What else predicts variance like that? In England, we have these very expensive school inspections. Every school gets inspected, thousands of schools, every 2, 3, 4 years. And a team of inspectors, government inspectors, goes in for 2 days. They cost about £20,000, say, to do this. And how much? These are good ratings of the schools. You know, it's not just how good the teachers teach, but it's the supportiveness of the environment and the atmosphere as they're bullying, that sort of thing. So these are probably the best you could do at trying to evaluate schools, the quality of a school. And it leads to these league tables. We rank schools as to how good they are. And then parents do a lot of weird things to get their kids into the best school. Well, how much of the variance in these educational achievement tests is explained by these expensive quality of school ratings? The answer is about 2%. So 2% versus 15% with DNA alone. I mean, you know, it's one of the most powerful predictors we have in the behavioral sciences. And we'll be able to predict more of the variants with these, but we're at the point now where these are some of our best predictors. And that's why this is where the DNA revolution is going to hit psychology. Because in any study, if you just collect the DNA, which, you know, spit in a tube and you get this DNA, and you can do the whole thing for 50 euros probably. And, you know, and then you think of fMRI or something like that would cost 500 euros a shot or something, you know, for an hour. It's really cheap to get DNA and to genotype it and to get these polygenic scores. And so what I'm encouraging psychologists to think about is just not becoming geneticists, just incorporate these things in your research, and they'll help you understand whatever you're interested in studying at another level of analysis. You don't have to become a geneticist. You don't need special samples like twins or adoptees. Just whatever you're studying, whatever group you're studying, if you collect the DNA, it's going to be a much richer study.